I'm Mike Collins. Once the dust settles on the voting in Iowa and New Hampshire, the Democratic race for president heads south.
Make no doubt about it, the road to the White House starts in South Carolina.
The first in the South primary has been pivotal in picking Democratic nominees. Will that be the case this year? Join Charlotte Talks for a preview of the upcoming vote. We'll be at Winthrop University's DiGiorgio Campus Center Wednesday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Register to attend and find more information at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday and the day of the Iowa caucuses, the first real test of the Democratic presidential field of candidates. Although this is a caucus, today kicks off a series of primaries that will ultimately decide who the Democratic presidential nominee is. Although there will be a Republican primary or two this season, the Republican nominee is a foregone conclusion. Following Iowa, candidates will rush to New Hampshire for their primary, then it's on to South Carolina, and then the Super Tuesday states, including us. But why do these primaries begin in the North, and specifically with Iowa and New Hampshire, every 4 years? Why do certain states seem to have more power in choosing the president? Why don't we have a national primary all on the same day? Come to think of it, why do we have primaries at all? We didn't used to. They're not in the Constitution. They're not enshrined in law. Is this really the best way to choose a president? Is it better than what came before? For answers to all those questions and many more, we turn to two primary experts. Elaine Kmark is author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. She's also a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, director of the Brookings Center for Effective Public Management, and a member of the Democratic National Committee. And she joins us from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Josh Putnam is also with us. He is a Wilmington-based political scientist who runs the Front-Loading HQ blog about presidential primaries and caucuses. He also writes for Rasmussen Reports 538 and The Washington Post. And he's with us from the studios of WHQR in Wilmington. Thank you for being here, too.
Good to be here, Mike.
If you'd like to join the conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Josh, let me start with you. And one of the questions I just asked, how did we come to have primaries, given that we didn't always have primaries?
Well, I mean, primaries go back to, or the formation of primaries goes back to kind of the early parts of the 20th century during the progressive reform movement that happened then. So it wasn't automatically presidential primaries that were coming out of that, but just primaries in general. And as the 20th century progressed, we saw more and more states kind of adopting a primary setup and moving towards using them as at least a signal. Not necessarily something that had a bearing on the convention at the end of the process, something that would inform delegates that were there potentially.
And as we'll explore this hour, Josh, the primary system seems to give, and I could be wrong about this, but it seems to give certain states more power and voters in those states more of a voice in the process. And that, all of that seems to me, at least, to fly in the face of one man, one vote. So strictly speaking, Josh, is this process constitutional?
There are several constitutional scholars that have looked at this and seem to suggest that yeah, it is constitutional. Again, we're talking about primaries, we're talking about presidential nomination processes, we're talking about the overlap of several interests. It's not only the national parties, but you've got state parties that are involved in that process as well, and state governments. When we talk about primaries themselves, they're often run by state governments, funded by state governments. Mm-hmm. So it's often hard to get all those interests on the same page in an agreement as to how things are supposed to progress and to make the process work.
Elaine, as Josh just pointed out, most of these primaries and caucuses are funded by state or local governments, except in the case of these firehouse caucuses that Kansas and Alaska are doing this year, where the party is paying the cost. The process pretty much is controlled by the political parties and not by the law and not by the states. So why is it a good thing that political parties have so much power in the process?
Well, because political parties are the ones who are responsible for nominating candidates to run for office. So under the First Amendment of the Constitution, there's something called freedom of association. And that says that Americans are free to form themselves into groups according to their interests. And the Supreme Court has for many years now protected Americans' freedom of association and protected the rights of the political parties to choose the person that runs in their name. So think of it as a branding issue, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the political parties do have a very significant interest in keeping their brand pure so that voters know what a Democrat stands for, what a Republican stands for, what a Green Party person stands for, what a Libertarian stands for. So the ultimate purpose of a political party is it gives voters a shortcut as to, you know, what this person may or may not stand for. And parties have a significant interest in controlling their brand.
Hmm. On the Republican side, we know what the Republican Party stands for, Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, you have Amy Klobuchar and Joe Biden. Then you have Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg. And all of them have their own brands, it seems to me. So, well, so does the nominee then become the party?
Yes, of course. Then, I mean, just as the Republican Party, which was a very different party before Trump, is now defined by Trump. And if you look at the five candidates that you just mentioned, they all have their own variations on the brand. But frankly, they are all Democrats. They all fit under the broad umbrella that is the Democratic Party. You won't find any of those candidates being right-to-life candidates, for instance. You don't find any of them being in favor of guns or no restrictions on guns. So, you know, there are big differences between the two political parties. And then when parties fight for the nomination, they are fighting over variations on a theme. They're not fighting over the fundamentals that differentiate one party from the other.
We all know that when we go to the general election, we're voting for electors. We may put Donald Trump's name on the little check mark, or last time it'd be Hillary Clinton's name on the in the box, but we're not really voting for them. We're voting for electors in the Electoral College, and God knows the Electoral College has had their say in recent years about who's going to be the president. All these people are out on the stump, Josh, campaigning, saying, vote for me, caucus for me tonight in Iowa. But in fact, the people who will caucus for whatever candidate they choose are caucusing for and in the primaries voting for delegates to the Democratic National Convention.
That's right. That's right.
Why? Why don't they just take the raw totals and say, that's the winner? That's our nominee.
It goes back to what we were talking about before in terms of how this process has evolved over time, right? I mean, there have always been delegates. There have been different ways of choosing who those delegates to the National Convention are going to be. So with the reforms after the 1968 presidential election that the Democratic Party put in place, it made the results in primaries and caucuses binding on the delegates that would go to the National Convention. And it serves as kind of a more representative way of getting the people's voices through voting in primaries and caucuses involved in the process, represented through those delegates. It was a pullback and away from the proverbial smoke-filled rooms that we've often heard about when talking about delegates prior to 68.
So let's talk about that, Elaine, because you've been a Democrat for a long time, and you were on, I think, the committee that moved us away from the smoke-filled rooms or something like it. Give us a thumbnail primer on how candidates were chosen up until the primary system really took over.
Mm-hmm. Well, in most states, for many, many years prior to 1972, You got to be a delegate to the convention by being a party activist, somebody who worked hard for the party, turned out the vote, was active in party affairs, and often was someone who was an elected official, a congressman, a mayor, a county commissioner, or somebody who was a party official, like the, you know, a precinct captain or a county captain. So in the old days, it was basically an inside process where people would run in precinct caucuses, county caucuses, and at a state convention they would elect delegates. This is essentially what the Iowa caucus still is, okay, with the exception of the fact that the numbers of people participating at that first caucus are huge compared to what it used to be. So all states prior to 1972 used to have some version of the Iowa caucus convention system. In 1968, the Democrats had a very contentious convention with anti-war protesters, anti-Vietnam War protesters, arguing that they had been shut out of the delegate selection process and that that was unfair. And what the people who ended up running the convention, Hubert Humphrey and LBJ's operatives, did was they said, oh, yeah, we'll have a reform commission following this terrible convention. We'll have a reform commission. It was sort of a sop to the protesters at the time. And it's interesting that no one really understood what was going to come out of that commission. And what came out of that commission was a very different system, a very public system, and one that came very quickly to be dominated by primaries and not by caucuses. So Iowa, Nevada, a handful of other states are really a throwback to a much, much earlier point in time. And these days we have primarily open presidential primaries, state financed by the state government, selecting delegates to the convention.
But in your mind, as a member of the Democratic National Committee, has this turned out to be a good thing for political parties, not just yours, but for the Republican Party as well? Because whereas in the past, the party bosses, the real operatives, the people who were in the trenches every day in politics, chose the candidate they thought would best represent them and all the factions in the party, the candidate who could negotiate with all the factions in the party and seal the deal for the presidential nomination. Now we leave it open a lot to people who are not as involved as you are, and we get candidates that may not be as good for the country.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, there's two trade-offs here, right? The old system was able to actually evaluate the candidates in a more holistic way, mostly because they tended to know the candidates and have had familiarity with them. And they could judge the candidate's ability to negotiate with their opponents, to their candidate's knowledge of issues, and the candidate's ability to represent everybody in the party and in the nation, not just the small number of people who managed to turn out for a caucus or a primary. So there were definitely advantages. There were disadvantages too, however. You know, it was restricted. It was hard for many years for African Americans, for women, for Latinos to get a place in these parties. They tended to be shut out. And with the open system, they tended to do better and have more of a voice. So, you know, you have trade-offs between the old system and the new system. I would frankly like to see a hybrid where some elements of the old system were there, but where the primary voters still had a major role.
I have a minute left in this segment, Josh, and I heard this morning that they're hoping for, Bernie Sanders folks are hoping for 250,000 people to turn out for the Iowa caucuses tonight. Put that into perspective in terms of the population of Iowa and how things turn out, the turnout in primaries. Is that greater than a primary turnout, less than a primary turnout? Is that a good turnout?
That's a great turnout for Iowa for the caucuses. I think we have to kind of take a step back and think about what caucuses are. It's not going into the voting booth like we do in a primary state, pulling the lever and leaving. We're talking about a commitment to a meeting, so it tends to tamp down on the turnout numbers. But In comparison to primary elections, the turnout in any caucus is usually going to be far below what we see in a primary.
And state. We're going to talk about how these caucuses work, because if you've never been to one or never participated in one, it's a very unusual situation. Josh Putnam is here along with Elaine Kmark. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Elaine Kmark is one of our guests. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates, and a member of the Democratic National Committee. She joins us from Washington. Josh Putnam is with us, political science from the Wilmington area, and the director of the Front Loading HQ blog. He also writes for the Washington Post and 538 and other publications. Today, as we have mentioned many times, is the first event of the campaign season, the big one, the Iowa caucuses. They are one of the last remaining caucus states. I think 10 states that held caucuses in 2016 have now switched to primaries, except for Iowa, Nevada, and Wyoming. Why are they sticking to caucuses, Josh?
Well, in Iowa's case, it's kind of their tradition, right? It has to do a lot with the interplay between the first two states. New Hampshire kind of protects its first in the nation status as the first primary state, and their state law says that no other similar contest can be before it. So that kind of puts Iowa in something of a bind. If they want to remain first, they have to keep the caucuses as part of their process.
And you called the caucuses obsolete, Elaine. Why?
Well, what happens in a caucus is because people have to go to a meeting and, you know, actually stay there and participate.
For hours.
Turnout is much, for at least sometimes 3 hours, sometimes more. Mm-hmm. Turnout is a fraction of what it is in a primary. So a turnout in a primary could be 1 million voters or more. And the biggest turnout we've ever seen in Iowa was the Obama year in 2008, when it topped 200,000. So obviously, if it goes to 250,000 tonight, that will be huge. But the fact of the matter is that these are the way we used to nominate presidential delegates to the nominating conventions. And we just don't anymore, because it's kind of a very old-fashioned and very difficult system to administer, particularly when you get a lot of people participating, which is why this year larger states like Minnesota and Washington State have abandoned their caucus system and gone to a primary.
Must you be a registered Democrat to participate in the Democratic primary in Iowa?
Oh, yes, you do. Yes.
Can independents vote in either of the if there's a caucus for Republicans, could they go either way?
Yeah, but they have to declare themselves a Democrat or a Republican and be recorded as such when they sign in. So now, they can't keep their independent status. They've decided to become, at least for that day, a Democrat or a Republican.
When you vote in a primary, Josh, you do it like we always go to the polls, privately, in a little voting booth. It's you keep it to yourself. And your ballot is secret. In caucuses, it's all out in the open. Talk about the process, because it seems to me that if you're a shy person or you don't have really strongly held convictions, you could be swayed.
Sure. If you're an introvert like me, you may not even go,
or
be just stuck as a wallflower at the side of the room. But, I mean, yeah, the early part of this is when people come in, they register, as Elaine just said, right, with the folks that are administering the caucuses, right? I mean, you've got the Biden folks in one corner of the room, you've got the Sanders folks in another corner, and you can kind of see shuffling into the room where everybody is, where the energy is, and that may have some influence on where you end up.
And so
that's
you,
not to count the second part of the process.
So if you go in and you think, some people have strongly, they know they want to vote for Bernie, okay? So they're going to go over to the Bernie corner of the room. Maybe I haven't made a decision. Maybe I'm open to anybody who can beat the Republican. Where do I go at the start of the evening? How do I do that?
You know,
well, that's when you're going to be approached by some of those other folks, right?
That's right. And usually, let's face it, people who turn out to caucuses are highly motivated politically. And they generally do have already have an idea of where they're going to go. They may not have an idea of where they're going to go second if their preferred candidate doesn't meet the 15% threshold, but they generally do have an idea of who they're going to vote for, or else they wouldn't take the trouble to get out there in the first place.
So let's start at the very beginning here. You got this big gymnasium. Let's just say they hold this one caucus. They're in different places, these caucuses, but let's just say this one's in the gymnasium. And you've got proponents of each candidate with their little signs in various corners of the room. I walk in. I'm going to vote for candidate Y. I find their sign. I walk over to that area. Is that correct so far?
That's right.
Okay, yep. I've gathered, and all the other candidate Y fans have gathered with me in the candidate Y area. And then everybody's gathering for candidate A, B, C, D, E, etc. How did they then determine that candidate Y does not have 15% of the room and therefore is no longer viable, and now I have to move on to my second choice? How does that work?
Well, they're counting you as... Yeah. Go ahead, Elaine.
When you sign in, you sign a card, right? You sign a card saying which candidate you're for and your name. And then you go to your corners. But while that's all happening, the chairman of the precinct caucus is counting the cards. Mm-hmm. So if your candidate Y, doesn't have 15% of the room, that is announced. And then the people who are in candidate Y's corner are free to go and join another group that does have more than 15%.
So if you haven't made up your mind, Josh, about who your second choice is and your first choice doesn't qualify, do people come over and say, hey, I got a reason for you to vote for candidate B. Come over here and we'll talk to you about it. Or do they just pull you by the arm sleeve and give you a cookie and say, you're in our group now? How does that work?
There may be a little bit of both of those things, but after what Elaine just described happens, right, they announce whether or not a candidate has viability or not. There's a 15-minute period, I think the rules suggest this time, where, again, it's open for those candidates and their supporters who have viability to persuade those who are looking for a second choice to come over and join them. And sometimes cookies are involved, and sometimes there's a discussion. I recall from watching some of the proceedings in 08, right? Biden in the precinct that was on C-SPAN did not get viability there. And some of his supporters were being lobbied by both Clinton folks and Obama folks at that point.
I was joking about cookies, but I actually did hear a story on NPR that there are cookies involved in many cases.
Yeah, I've heard that too. Yeah, cookies and popcorn. Somebody asked me the other day is how about hard cold cash? And I said, as far as I know, the Iowans are they're pretty straight laced folks. As far as I know, there's never been hard cold cash offered.
So how long does this shuffling go on? You go to your first caucus position, and maybe two or three candidates don't make the cut. And then you go to your second position. Could it happen again? I mean, how many times does this happen in the evening, Elaine?
It only happens once, because the people who are above the 15% threshold are not allowed to regroup. Now, so that stays constant. It isn't a constant shuffling, or else, you know, this could take all night. And what often happens, sometimes if you really don't have a second choice, some people just go home. You know, they just leave. Okay. Mm. And in fact, after each step in this process, people do leave. So by 10 o'clock at night or so, you know, you're left with really the hardcore political junkies.
So why does it take 3 hours? I mean, it's pretty quick to me. If your candidate is below 15%, you're going to find that out pretty quickly. And then you're going to make your second choice or be coerced into it. Somebody's going to talk to you about coming over here or coming over there. How long can that possibly take?
Well, it does take a while. There's several things happen. There's the first vote. Then there's what they call the realignment, where people below 15% have to go find another candidate. Then that vote has to be counted, okay, to see which candidates picked up voters. And then there needs to be a translation to delegate equivalents. And then the caucus elects actual people to send to the county convention representing those presidential candidates who come out above 15%. And then sometimes, and this happens in, by the way, these happen in both parties, sometimes then people debate platform issues that they'd like to see taken up at the county convention. So there's a lot of business. Now, at each point in this, some people go home, right? Some people that are not interested, or some people's babysitting time is up and they got to go let the babysitter go home. It is a school night after all. So a variety of things happen. By the end of the evening, it's generally a little smaller than at the beginning.
So all of this, Josh, is out in the open, as we've talked about before. And your neighbor knows who you want and if and how you change your preference as the night goes on. Are participants open to coercion or even recrimination because you didn't come to my group after your guy lost? Do people hold it against each other, or do they just look at this as democracy?
Well, I think they look at it as both democracy and the way that Iowa has traditionally done this, right? I mean, I think going back to Elaine's point about cold hard cash and the exchange of that, right? Iowans take this process very seriously, right? Acknowledge that, hey, my neighbor may choose someone other than the one that I've chosen.
Elaine said that this usually involves more informed voters. They know who they want, most of people, when they come into the room. Does it produce more informed voters? In other words, if you go in for a candidate who doesn't win and you have to be persuaded to vote for one of the others, do you walk away from this process knowing more than you would if you just voted in a primary, Josh?
I suppose it depends on whether you've been given cookies or not. But if that's the main thing to get you to switch, then perhaps not. But yeah, I mean, I think we should look on this process as a potential learning opportunity. Again, if to the extent it's an exchange of information, of policy positions that allows for one group to persuade some folks below the 15% threshold to come and join them, then yeah, you may see some learning on that.
I believe this number is right, Elaine. There are 1,681 caucus locations in Iowa, and in those caucuses, a candidate, as we've said, has to get 15% of the vote if they want to win any delegates to the convention. That's also true of primaries. You got to win votes to get delegates. Does that mean that candidates who get less are immediately removed from contention? They'll have no representation from that state in the convention. Is that correct?
Well, I think you're jumping ahead, but basically in Iowa, the 15% you have no representation at the county convention.
Okay.
That does not necessarily mean you have no representation at the national convention, because there may be other precincts and other counties that voted for you. So you're going to win in these. There's so many. There's 1,681. You're going to win in some and win in, you know, and lose in the others. In a primary state, this is by congressional district. So if you fall below 15% in one congressional district, you're not going to get any delegates from that district. You might, however, qualify for a delegate or two or three from a neighboring district where you did better. So it's not that people get they overestimate what this 15% means. It happens at a district level, and so it's very complicated. You can't say automatically somebody's going to get no delegates if they don't get a delegate in one place.
So Larry emails a question that we probably have already answered, but maybe not. Are there winners and losers in caucuses? Is the purpose of these caucuses to refine the rankings, Josh?
Refine the rankings of the candidates themselves?
I guess.
Yeah.
Who's the leader? You know, who's the second person?
Right. So, I mean, I think we've got an idea of you know, the ordering of candidates heading into Iowa tonight. We've got a kind of an upper tier of Sanders and Biden and Warren and Buttigieg and Klobuchar maybe gaining on the outside of that group. So, I mean, again, those are our expectations heading in. We kind of analyze the results that will come in tonight relative to those expectations. So if Joe Biden finishes a distant sixth or seventh, then that's a problem for him and his campaign, and has the potential to reorder the candidates for subsequent contests in the sequence.
Because of primaries and caucuses, these political conventions have become little more than a TV commercial for the party and its chosen candidate. I remember when the conventions made news, when you didn't know who the candidate was until the convention started and people got together in smoke-filled rooms and voted and re-voted and voted again. It gave the conventions, Elaine, uncertainty and drama. And as a Democrat, a member of the committee, why don't the political parties want that at their conventions?
Well, because there's drama throughout the spring now with the primaries. I mean, the drama, remember, the reason Iowa and New Hampshire are so important is because they are first. And the nomination process is now a sequential process. So it begins in February and it ends in July at the convention. And there's a lot of drama during that period of time. We've sort of exchanged the drama at the convention for the drama as you move from week to week, seeing who's up and who's down in these primary races. Iowa, generally, the saying among political folks is there are three tickets out of Iowa, okay, first, second, and third. And as Josh explained, a lot of the interpretation coming out of Iowa depends on what the expectations were going in. So the expectations are very high for Bernie Sanders right now, and they're very low for, say,
Andrew Yang.
Andrew Yang, yes, very low for Andrew Yang. That's a good one. And if for some reason Bernie Sanders were to come in fifth and Andrew Yang were to come in second, now that would be quite a story and viewed as an upset. So, and that process, by the way, repeats itself over a period of 6 months, right? Where you've just got constant change and drama in the race for the presidency. Sometimes it's over early, but recently we tend to go on all the way through the spring.
So the media gets a lot of flack for covering the horse race and not the issues that the candidates may want to talk about. We always want to know who's leading, who's jockeying just behind, who's coming up from out of the pack. But it seems to me the media is not to blame for this. It is the primary system that is to blame for this. You've taken the drama from the conventions that are 4 or 5 days and spread it out over 5 or 6 months. We have to cover that. Is this doing damage to the country? Josh.
I think we have to. What comes into this is we've been doing this, right? As much as we want to talk about the process for the next 4 or 5 months that's going to be going on leading up to the convention, we should say this has been going on for a long time. One could argue that some of these candidates were kind of making maneuverings towards running as early as late 2016 in some cases. So there is a learning process that takes place across this giant expanse of time that we have.
And
the media plays a part in that.
The other part of this is who goes first and the order of these primaries around the country and why it's the same and what that does to the process. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and on this Politics Monday, we're talking about the Iowa caucuses and the primary system with Elaine Kmark, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. She joins us from Washington. Josh Putnam joins us from Wilmington. He's a political scientist there, the head of the Front Loading HQ blog, and he writes for the Rasmussen Report and 538, the Washington Post, and others. Elaine mentioned how long the Iowa caucuses have been going on and why New Hampshire has in its state law that they are the first primary in the country. So if somebody tries to jump the gun on them, they'll just move their primary, which is partly why Iowa keeps its caucus system, because it wants to be the first in the country. They're not a primary. They're a caucus. Both of these states seem overly influential for many reasons. One, they're both small states with small populations. Two, they're also very white. 90% white people in both cases. And that seems to go against the grain of the Democratic Party's philosophy. So why did Democrats continue to order the primaries in this fashion, Josh?
Well, if it was so easy to uproot Iowa and New Hampshire, it probably would have been done by now. This isn't a new issue for either party. It kind of goes back to something I mentioned early on in our discussion today, which is you've got all these interests that are involved. It's state-level interests, both state parties, state governments, and the national party. And trying to get all of those folks on the same page to make changes is hard. Again, if it was easy, it would have been done already.
Why did it happen in the first place? Why is it that these two tiny states tend to pick the front runners? And in Iowa's case, the winner of the Iowa caucuses is usually the nominee in the Democratic Party.
There is some influence there, yeah. But yeah. But why it kind of goes back to the evolution of the system. Mm-hmm. New Hampshire had traditionally had a March primary, which was very early on in the initial process, when primaries did not have a direct bearing on the delegates heading to the convention.
So let me ask a member of the Democratic National Committee, Elaine, the first four primaries will produce about 4% of the delegates at the Democratic Convention. Why allow this paltry number of delegates produced by the four early state primaries in February, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina? Why give them such an oversized impact on the field of candidates? Why does this make sense?
Well, because in a sequential system, you got to keep going back to the fact that this is a sequence, somebody's got to be first. So the question is, who's first? And various states have complained about this for a long time, saying, we should be first, no, we should be first, no, we should be first. Iowa and New Hampshire are small enough that, and South Carolina and Nevada, that presidential candidates can do something in those states that they cannot do in larger states, and that is to actually campaign with real voters. Once you get out of those four states and you go to Super Tuesday, the campaign moves from real people to television studios and radio studios. And that's the extent to which people get to actually see these candidates. So if you think that it is important, and a lot of people have for a long time, that the process start in a state that's small enough to do retail campaigning,
only those people in those small states, a tiny number of people, get to shake hands and eat barbecue with these folks. Why is that important?
Well, because they actually get to shake hands with
them. Well, then toss it up. Why can't Nebraska go first next time? Let those people have barbecue.
Well, there have been plans to do that. There have been, the Republicans about a decade ago had a very interesting plan about rotating the first states. The problem is that at this point in time, the voters and the politicians in Iowa and New Hampshire, they fight like crazy to retain their first state.
Right.
In the union. And voters in other states don't. They don't care as much. And so there's a sort of question of intensity here. Mm.
So we have these four primaries and caucuses in the month of February, and then Super Tuesday. North Carolina has the third highest number of delegates at stake in the Super Tuesday primaries. And we have traditionally been late in this process. Our primary used to fall after the nominee was already a foregone conclusion. That's why we moved our primary up and joined Super Tuesday states. California is not always in Super Tuesday. They are this year, and they're the big kahuna. This begs the question, why isn't there just one national primary, one day in which everybody in every state has a caucus or a primary, and we're done with it? Wouldn't that be
fair? There's an argument to be made for the sequential system, right? Though there are trade-offs involved there, right, as Elaine just described. But again, that retail politics part of this is important. And if we switch from that to a national primary, it would tend to advantage the candidates that are able to raise the most money up front and air ads across the whole country, as opposed to again, being on the ground, shaking hands, kissing babies, talking to voters about actual issues as they do in smaller states.
California lets their primary voters mail in their votes, which tends to delay the vote count from a very big state. And they also used to vote late, which delayed the impact of the ton of delegates that they present at the convention. This time they will be voting on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, with us. Does that mean, when you add California to Super Tuesday, that the decision on who the nominee will be in the Democratic Party will effectively be made that day before voters, say, in New York have a chance to chime in, Josh?
It certainly could be. If one candidate kind of sweeps through these first four contests, then Super Tuesday could prove decisive. But if we see a split of any variety among two or three candidates heading into Super Tuesday, you may see a situation where the voters in Super Tuesday states, including North Carolina, California, et cetera, split among those candidates and lead us toward a more contested environment later on and possibly into the convention.
In the last 15 presidential races, South Carolina has gone for the Democrat only twice. This is from Dan in Granite Falls. JFK and Carter were the times they went for Democrats in South Carolina. And he says, I understand the argument for diversity in an early primary, but should Democrats be comfortable with reliably red South Carolina potentially ending the campaign of a candidate who might appeal to voters in crucial swing states? Should the Ohio or Florida primaries count more, Elaine?
Well, the reason that the Democratic and Republican parties agreed to put South Carolina in that important position was, first, it was a small southern state, I think the smallest of the southern states. Secondly, on the Democratic side, the South Carolina Democratic electorate is heavily African American. And the thought was that that would be a place to test a candidate's attractiveness to the African American community. And while the African American community in South Carolina is not big enough to deliver the state for the Democrats, as the caller indicated, in subsequent states, the African American community is critically important to putting Democrats over the top. And so South Carolina became a good test for the African American community, and Nevada was placed early because it became a good test for the Latino community.
Democrats, so we're going to these caucuses tonight. We're not, but Iowans are. And then we're going to come here in March and go to a primary. And all we're doing is electing delegates to the convention. Democrats also have a category of delegates called superdelegates. And Elaine, you were on the committee that created superdelegates. You've served as a superdelegate. In previous years, those delegates were party officials who could choose whom they wanted to support. They weren't locked in. This year, I'm told, superdelegates can't impact the outcome of the first vote at the convention, which will, I'm told again, make it easier for a candidate to reach that magic number to win earlier in the season. Am I right? You've effectively neutered the superdelegates? And if so, why? Why have them in the first place if you're going to take away their power?
Well, it was a classic political compromise between supporters of Bernie Sanders who thought that having the superdelegates was unfair and others who thought that having the superdelegates was a reflection of the reality of governing, that a president needed to govern with his members of Congress of his party and senators and governors. So it was a classic political compromise. So the way it stands now is that these elected officials will be delegates to the convention, and they will be able to vote on everything except on the first ballot. And then if the party can't, if there's no clear decision on a first ballot, nobody gets a majority, then in fact the superdelegates are allowed to vote on the second ballot. They're sort of tiebreakers.
Given the primary system that leads to a nominee before the convention opens its doors, is there going to be a second ballot?
Well, there hasn't been in the entire post-reform era. We haven't seen second ballots since the 50s. So I would have to say I doubt it very much. On the other hand, we could very well see this time what I call a contested convention, where somebody who tries to break open the convention someone maybe has a very narrow lead and there's a fight at the convention, usually that takes place over some other issue than the actual first ballot. It takes place over a rules issue. It takes place over a platform issue or a credentials issue. So we could see a lively convention depending on the outcome of the primaries.
So let's talk about that, because some have fretted about how these early primaries and caucuses could create a four-way cluster of front runners and lead to that brokered convention. Josh, in your mind, how likely is that to happen, and what would be the impact if that did happen and you got this four-way race on the convention floor?
It would be a mess, for starters.
But wouldn't it be fun?
It would absolutely be fun. I mean, I think the standard line that I've used since 2016 is that if we were going to see a contested convention, it would have been on the Republican side 4 years ago. That may change as we get into primary season this time around. But I'm one who has studied the system long enough to know that we tend to, through this sequence, see the field of candidates winnow down to a manageable set, usually someone who's leading and an alternative to that leader, which suggests a two-person race sooner rather than later, and that augurs against a contested convention.
If we don't have a contested convention, at what point do you think, Josh, we'll know who the Democratic nominee is? Can you look in the past and see when that person emerged as a result of primary collective vote totals and predict this time around about what time in the year we'll know who the nominee is?
I think it's more important to look at how the calendar is laid out from cycle to cycle, because they're not the same, right? Other than Iowa and New Hampshire going first, the states behind them shuffle from cycle to cycle. So with California, with Texas, with North Carolina on that first Tuesday in March, you've got a lot of delegates at stake. So we probably should know relatively early on, I guess, in March. I'd suggest between Super Tuesday and, say, St. Patrick's Day, when Illinois and Ohio and Florida go, whether or not we're going to see a healthy enough split in the delegates that have been allocated to that point to kind of keep a battle going on through the rest of primary season and potentially into the convention.
Elaine, the Democrats have a guy in the race who is doing things rather unconventionally. Billionaire Michael Bloomberg, he got in late. He's spending a ton of his own money in states other than the early primary states. He set up campaign operations in those other states, in states that many of the candidates haven't even gotten to yet because they're focusing on the early primaries. He's running scads of television commercials in those areas well in advance of the candidates in the race arriving there. Could this approach throw what we assume about how primaries work into chaos this year?
Well, it could. I mean, it is very, very novel. You know, and what we don't know is what the effect of all that money will be. I can tell you that a former mayor of New York, Rudy Giuliani, tried exactly the same thing years ago. He tried to skip all the early contests and make his first run in Florida. This was in 2008. And what happened is by the time the Florida primary came around, nobody was paying any attention to him. They were paying attention to John McCain, who made a dramatic comeback. And Giuliani got 14% of the vote in Florida and got out of the race the day afterwards. So this strategy was a failed strategy for a different New York mayor. Now, the difference, of course, is Rudy Giuliani did not have the unlimited amounts of money that Michael Bloomberg has. And so we don't know whether on Super Tuesday, Michael Bloomberg's paid media will be enough to offset the free media that gets attached to the one or two or three candidates who are coming out of the early contests. again, there's no precedent for this, no precedent for that amount of money, and we'll have to wait and see. And like Josh, by the way, I've been telling people St. Patrick's Day 2020, we'll have a very good sense of what this race looks like.
Okay. The primary system makes the Republican Party candidates skew to the right and speak to the right-hand side of their party. It makes the Democratic Party candidates speak to the left-hand side of their party, and it polarizes our politics even more than they've already been polarized, Josh. Should we think of another way to do this, given that that's what happens?
This also goes back to something I said earlier on, right? This concept of trying to change things up, right? If it was easy to change the system, it would have been done in the past. What we've tended to see is a layer of reforms added on top of the pre-existing system and so on and so forth.
Josh Putnam is a political scientist from Wilmington. He joined us from WHQR. He's running the Front-Loading HQ blog. Elaine Kmark is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.